Is everyone settled? We can begin. I'd like to introduce our guest, Simon Haas. It seems many of you know him because you're in study groups, some of you with his books. So I'm going to explain how this program happened. And it started one day. I was in the Bhakti Center, and I was coming from the sixth floor. Some of you may be familiar there, where I was staying. And as you come down to the fifth floor, there's a door that basically opens right next to the steps. That's one of their seminar halls. And it was right before one of their community groups. And then Betty came to me, because we have this nice relationship, and she started talking about this book, about Simon Haas, and how finally she's understood her relationship with Krishna. And finally, she's a... And in my mind, I'm going, Simon Haas. I mean, this is like Prabhupada Nugas, and, you know, Prabhupada disciples were trying so hard to invite Betty and Simon Haas. Who is Simon Haas? So I'm trying to figure it out, you know, because, you know, all of a sudden she understands her relationship with Krishna. So I went back, and then, of course, we have, you know, Google and things like that. So I look at Simon Haas, and who is Simon Haas? And I started going down the, and I see all these devotees that, you know, on, you know, the threads. Congratulations on your new book and this. And I'm just trying to figure out, who is Simon Haas? And then I see this one person that kind of I knew him. And then I figured out, okay. And then I realized that this is, now this is Sundar Gopal, but this is Shalagram. And that he was with me in Vrindavan. Not only was with me in Vrindavan, but he told me that he stayed in my room.
For a year.
So I was then I was remembering, you know, who he was, and he came to Vrindavan. You know, at the time, we had also started a Vrindavan Institute for Higher Education, and that was like the first institute in ISKCON to study the Shastra deeply. And also we had a good Sanskrit teacher, Satyanarayan Das, Sanskrit scholar. So various reasons he came. And then somehow or other he had become inspired by one senior Gaudiya Vaishnava named Srila Narayan Maharaj, who I had a relationship with. I actually knew him. I actually studied some time with him also in Vrindavan. So I knew him. So I at that time I had, well, you know, he's a young man, so I actually brought him to meet Srila Narayan Maharaj. He met him before, but I brought him, and then shortly after that he took initiation and from him, and then traveled with him and studied Sanskrit and studied the Vaishnava literature, etc. So one thing that I learned from Narayan Maharaj, and I remember this was a particular thing. I'm going to reveal a lot of confidential things now that, you know, I was among a group of people that wanted to bring Srila Narayan Maharaj to the West. And actually, when I first met him, it was really interesting. What happened was is that he had performed the Fire Yajna when his guru, Narayan Maharaj's guru, gave Prabhupada sannyas. So he had performed the Fire Yajna when Prabhupada took sannyas. And after Srila Prabhupada had left, The world works in strange ways. Don't try to wrap your mind around it. Prabhupada's oldest son sued ISKCON for all the assets of ISKCON because in Indian law, the older son automatically inherits the property of the father unless the father took sannyas. So there had to be a case to prove that Prabhupada took sannyas, but the lawyer in Mathura, these are so many things being revealed to the world now that not known before, but the lawyer in Mathura had screwed up the documents. So there was a court case, and the Narayan Maharaj went for 1 month to Mathura to defend ISKCON, and he had to sit every single day for 8 or 10 hours in the courts waiting for his time to speak. So at that time he was being hosted by ISKCON, and at that time Srila Tamal Krishna Maharaj was writing a book on the Brahma Samhita, and Srila Narayan Maharaj is a great Vaishnav scholar. So they became good friends. And then when Tamal Krishna Maharaj came back, he started to tell us about that. And we knew at that time of Narayan Maharaj, he was famous for his kirtans. We also knew that when Prabhupada came to the West, he didn't have any kartals. And that Narayan Maharaj was shipping things from Mathura, including Mathura Pera. Every city in India has a special sweet, which I know of. So he was doing a lot of this service, and when Prabhupada left the world, he gave instructions, because we didn't know the technicalities of the installation of Prabhupada's samadhi. So when Prabhupada passed away and I was there, it was Narayan Maharaj that supervised Prabhupada's disciples to do the samadhi ceremony for Prabhupada, and wrote on Prabhupada's chest the samadhi mantra, I think in Tilak, Radha Dasyam mantra. So there's many things. And we would invite him to different ceremonies to speak and things. So it was this cordial relationship that was going on there. So I had this kind of relationship with Narayan Maharaj. And then when Tamal Krishna Maharaj came back and said he studied and it was nice, then I said, okay, I also would like to learn, you know? So I remember I went with him to see Narayan Maharaj in Mathura. At that time, he didn't take any disciples because in his mutt, they just had one acharya, and he wasn't the acharya, so he's very popular. So I used to go, I went to Mathura, but at that time, he didn't speak English. So you had to have a translator. So he said, you know, we would like to study something here. I went with my friend, I don't know, you know, and we'd like to study something here. You know, he said, what? I said, well, Jivadharma. The Jivadharma is a book by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. It's a brilliant novel where it discusses all the tattvas or truths of Krishna consciousness in a novel form of people coming to Krishna consciousness the time after Lord Chaitanya. And as the people would come, who the person would come would need a different truth. So the first person came was a Mayavadi sannyasi, then a materialistic person came, then a Brahmin came. And then finally these people surrender and you get the whole teachings in summary of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu and Ujjvala Nilamani. So we went. We'd like to, you know, to study Jivadharma. I didn't know what the book was, really. I just thought it sounded interesting. So he looked at us and said, so you want to understand Raghunuga Bhakti? And he went like this, Anya Bilashita Shunya. You have to have no material desires. So I said, no, we just, you know, wanted to play. But he said, I will teach you Jiva Dharma. I was with my friend who's an educator, if you teach me English. It's kind of, he knew English, but he wasn't in practice. So that was the deal, and we used to come. And a lot of important instructions in my life, significant things actually came. I remember I was going to take sannyas, and I was half mad, 31 years old, and I'm going to become this lifelong celibate. You know, we did crazy things. But then I was supposed to take sannyas, but at that time in ISKCON, it was called the Acharya system. You had to take, not from who you were inspired by, but who is the person who is the head of that particular area. But there was a problem. The person who's in charge of my particular area was a wonderful person and a great manager, but he wasn't a real good renunciate. Even though he was a sannyasi, he wasn't at all a renunciate. So I thought, well, this is a little strange. So I went to Narayan Maharaj and I asked him for advice. And I said, you know, I don't really feel that this person's going to inspire me in my renunciation, but, you know, you have to anyway take from the person and, you know, and anyway, it's just a formality. And then he looked at me and he said, there's no formalities in Vaishnav relationships. He said, all relationships have to be substantial. That gave me the inspiration, and fortunately then I got the courage and the intelligence how to manipulate this so that I could take sannyas from His Holiness Satsarup Maharaj, who's, you know, a great Vaishnav soul and things like that, and many things. And another incident, I'm just going to explain this about taken to the West, but then it seemed like there was going to be some problems in doing so. Because each Vaishnava has their particular mood, their particular perspective, and people were afraid that his emphasis and perspective would not really fit within Islam's perspective. So someone sent the message through me to actually go and tell him that probably better that you don't go. So I went. Should I give the background music for this? So I'm delivering the message, right? And I say, you know, I got the message from someone else who was like a leader that it's better that you don't go, because if you say something different from Prabhupada, there's going to be a disturbance, right? He said, I cannot say something different than Prabhupada. How can I say something different than Prabhupada? And then line from Bhakti Siddhanta, he said, but if they think that way, better I should not go. He said, because Vaishnav is one who promotes faith in Guru. And you know, I felt, I'm going to say honestly, like my fortune of growing up in India in Krishna consciousness for like 40 years and meeting people from this generation and the culture and wisdom they have and these type of things which stuck in my heart and you know, I just followed for the rest of my life. Vaishnav is one who promotes faith in Guru. You may like, you may not, but and things like that, or I can think of many, many, or there's no formalities in Vaishnava. And I remember another one he said to me, in another particular instance, where also I was to be the deliverer from Narayan Maharaj to news to someone else, right? And he said, tell this person, it was also leadership, he said, tell this person, when a Vaishnava makes a mistake or something, when a Vaishnava asks for forgiveness or something like that, it's all gone. And he went with his hand like this, it's gone. And then for the rest of my life, just from these powerful instructions, I followed it as Shastra, to never consider a Vaishnava's past. Even if I was in conflict with them, even if I can get them back, even if I can get an advantage, because I understood when it comes, Acharya Purusho Veda, when things come from great teachers and acharyas and from Prabhupada and Prabhupada's followers. I was just with Prema's guru yesterday, Narayan, Srila Narayan Maharaj, and just sitting there, Srila Naranjan Swami. Yeah, it's the same thing. Srila Naranjan Swami, and just going to a soul of that caliber. And basically, whatever he told me, I went to consult him. Whatever he told me, I just, you know, one time he told, Srila Naranjan Swami told me, I was in a real heavy crisis, like a real heavy crisis. And he gave me the instruction. He said, if you tolerate, there'll be a fruit at the end. And that gave me the strength and courage, because he said it from realization, from someone who actually lived that and saw it. So that gave me the courage and things to tolerate so many things and understand that if you just tolerate and move forward, there's always a fruit at the end. So I gave my introduction, and Simon is, you know, I'm here often, he's not here, he'll be here once, and I began to read one of his books, and I have to say it's brilliant. I just want to give, you know, the phone is ringing or something.
It's down the side of the couch.
What?
It's on the side of the couch. Down the side of the pillow. Here,
okay. Pretty true. I'm like, I can't answer it now. I would like to, though. So, what was I saying? Yeah, so I'm going to give a criticism of the book first, because I think that's fair, you know, otherwise you think you're just... The criticism of the book is, each sentence is so profound and has so much information that it's hard to read through the book. It's just so many good things in that book, and it's just an amazing book. So what I'd actually like to do is ask him to just speak, you know, on one of the books, or summarize the book, or summarize some point, or what his inspiration is. And I think one good thing is about realization is you can communicate. And one thing about communication is you're able to express it to your audience, and you're also able to put it in any size you want. So it's a lot to speak about, but I'd like you to just share about the book. This is a great audience. They're very inquisitive, and then we can have questions and afterwards discussions. Okay.
It's an honor to meet you all.
What is the thing, right? Okay.
Well, first I want to offer my Dandavat Pranam to Maharaj. I think that the real reason for coming to New York was not the UN. That was simply like a cover for me to have the chance to meet Maharaj again after 25 years. I feel completely indebted to him, because it's through him that my Guru Maharaj gave me initiation. So I've been thinking about him so many times over the years, but our paths never crossed until today. And I've learned so much from him. staying in India back in 1991 and 1994. I would like to say first something about these two particular books. I honestly actually don't consider them to be my books. So although, you know, by convention a book has to have an author's name at the bottom, I really feel more like just a translator. These are teachings from our great lineage of acharyas. And the purpose of these two books has been to create a cultural translation and make it easily accessible to contemporary readers and audiences. Yoga and the Dark Night of the Soul, in particular, I noticed that in yoga studios around the world, they're studying the Sutras of Patanjali, which is a great book for yoga practice, but it has very little about bhakti, just maybe the fifth niyama, Ishvara Pranidhana, and not much else at all. And the Bhagavad Gita, which I know is a book that Dhanadhar Swami loves very much and is an expert in, is largely neglected in yoga studios around the world, even though it's a classic on yoga. Each of the 18 chapters of the Gita is a different system of yoga. So the very first chapter is known as, goes by two names. One of them is observing the armies. Another is Vishad Yoga, or the yoga of despair, the yoga of crisis. And then there are other systems of yoga in the Gita. And often the Gita is taught in a way that is quite philosophical and difficult to, sometimes it can be difficult to apply it in everyday life. But the Gita actually is a book that is intended to be extremely practical, something that can be used every day. So usually when I go to a yoga studio, I tell the audience, if you don't have a tool set that you can use in your life right away, then I haven't done my job. Arjuna, after listening to the Gita, he doesn't go to the forest to contemplate philosophy. His first use of the teachings of Krishna, yoga teachings of Krishna, is actually on the battlefield. So the teachings of the Gita have different levels of meaning, and our acharyas explain that. There is the literal meaning, for example. There's an ethical dimension. There's a symbolic dimension. One great teacher in our lineage, Sri Madhvacharya, explains some of the symbolic meaning of the Bhagavad Gita and Mahabharata in his book Mahabharata Tatparya. So, for example, do you all know the background of the Gita and the Mahabharata? So you all know about Duryodhana, main character in the Gita. So he represents something or someone. Does anyone know? He represents this age of Kali Yuga. So there are many deeper meanings in the teachings of the Gita that Sri Madhvacharya and others have explained. Madhvacharya's view is that the Pandava who has the dearest relationship with Krishna is Bhima. Which is very interesting, because Madhvacharya is a manifestation of Vayu, and Bhima is a manifestation of Vayu. So Madhvacharya is thinking, I have the closest relationship to Krishna. So the Bhagavad Gita is a conversation that happens in a most surprising location. Most of the teachings of ancient India are, the setting is like a beautiful forest, the bank of a river, or the bank of a lake. But the Bhagavad Gita is in the middle of a battlefield between two armies. It's like striking. There's no sacred text like it, actually. So the battlefield is known as Kurukshetra. Kshetra means field, and Kuru comes from the verbal root Kri, which refers to action. So the symbolic meaning is that Kurukshetra is the field of action. So we're actually all on the field of action. Where does action take place? There's only one place in the entire universe that action takes place. And that's the present moment. Any action that we took in the past, we took when it was the present. Any action we will take in the future, we'll take when it's the present moment. So Kurukshetra for us is the field of now. And the field of now can sometimes be very much like a battlefield. Frenetic, chaotic, unexpected changes in fortunes. So how can we make the field of now a sacred place in which to act? On one level, that's what the Bhagavad Gita is about. And to show Arjuna, the warrior Arjuna, how to do that, Krishna gives him 18 different systems of yoga. These are very powerful tools. Each one of those is a very, very powerful tool. Have a look just at a few of them, so you have a sense. But although I get the impression that you're all very familiar with the Gita already. So one system is karma yoga, the yoga of skillful action. In that particular part of the Gita, Krishna defines yoga as yoga karmasu kaushalam. Yoga is skillfulness in action. So we actually are, especially in contemporary West, we're experts in how to act unskillfully. So many ways that we act unskillfully in our everyday life. You know, when we're stuck in traffic, how we respond to that, in our relationships, in our communication. So Krishna teaches Arjuna and teaches all of us how to act skillfully. And karma yoga has three simple steps. The teachings are very simple, not always so easy to apply in our life. It requires commitment and attention and awareness. But three simple steps to act skillfully. Another system of yoga. The yoga of differentiating between the three gunas. Incredible. You all know, I think, about sattva, rajas, and tamas. It's actually difficult to find good English translations because English is a deficient language. So sometimes we say goodness, passion, and ignorance. Tamas means darkness, literally. Sattva literally means beingness. So you know how in Buddhism, the word mindfulness is very popular. Most of the teachings of Buddhism relating to the nature of this world, other than that this world is an illusion, that's not actually the teachings of ancient India, the Vedic teachings of ancient India. But the nature of this world as a place of suffering comes from the sacred texts of India. And mindfulness, the closest to mindfulness, is sattva. Sattva means beingness. When someone is situated in sattva, they're completely mindful and self-satisfied, not looking for their happiness in the outside world. They find their happiness from within. And rajas is that particular quality in the field of perception where we're looking, always hankering for something. So the field of perception is always changing, being influenced by these three gunas, these three qualities. You can even think of them as forces, because the qualities have a pull. So someone who practices this particular system of yoga, they can differentiate and they can see the gunas in action all around them, in how people speak. So, you know, I think we've all had this experience where, say at Christmas time, you're with your family, you see all the three types of communication in rajas, in tamas, in sattva. When someone speaks when we communicate in tamas, our primary intent is destructive. We're looking to take the other person down, minimize the other person, criticize them. We may also speak to ourselves in tamas, where we're continually putting ourselves down and minimizing speaking to ourselves in a way that's not constructive but destructive. In Sanskrit, that's known as vitanga. There's a second kind of communication, which is known as jalpa, where our primary aim is not necessarily destructive, but it's to force our own position. So we want to show how intelligent we are. We want to show that we're right. We want to convince others to do something. That's communication in rajas. And communication in sattva, we're completely open to the other person without any agenda. Now, I think we've all had this experience. Two people, when they're communicating in sattva, you feel nourished and alive from that conversation. And there's a sense of intimacy and friendship. You feel like there's a connection of two worlds. And we feel vitality from that conversation. That's because it's conversation in sattva. So usually our conversations are mixed. You never find sattva, rajas, or tamas completely on their own. There's always they're competing forces. But by understanding the gunas, we can see how someone is approaching us with a particular communication. We recognize immediately what's happening, and you can redirect it, or you can change the energy of that, or not be influenced by it. So it's very, very powerful. Another way that the gunas is so relevant and important is when we start a project or start anything, start a relationship, a project, a business. If we start something in tamas or in rajas, that quality will be carried throughout our efforts and the results will be accordingly. So the results of tamas is destructiveness. The results of rajas are mixed. The results of sattva is stability, durability. So, you know how in the continual battle between the devatas and the asuras, the demons and demigods, the devas are always victorious. That's because one reason is that they take shelter of Vishnu, but they know how to use the quality of sattva in their favor. And sattva has that stability and durability. So this particular yoga system is incredible because you can really be effective in everyday life by applying it. And then Krishna explains to Arjuna how to even go further than that, how to transcend the three gunas. In yoga studios, I don't normally speak so much about that, because I've seen some people speaking quite cheaply about transcending the gunas, but perhaps, you know, struggling to reach sattva. So another system of yoga is an incredible system of yoga. It's actually called Deva Asura Vibhag Sampad Yoga. So it's the Sampad means wealth. It's the yoga of being able to differentiate or discover the wealth of the gods and goddesses as opposed to the wealth of the asuras. So we spend our life, we come into this world naked, not without owning anything. And we will leave this world without anything, because nothing we'll be able to take with us. But somehow, between that point of not owning anything and that point of not only anything, not even our physical bodies, we accumulate and we take this view that this is mine, it belongs to me, and I'm going to guard it and protect it. And we accumulate, especially in our society, in the Western world, which has become globalized now. So in this particular system of yoga, we look very carefully at what it is we're accumulating. And we try to accumulate the wealth of the gods and goddesses. Beautiful qualities, incredible qualities like humility, compassion, service to others. It reminds me of one passage in the Gita, which is really quite striking. Arjuna asks Krishna, he wants to know what is knowledge. So Krishna begins to explain. But rather than explain knowledge in the way we might expect, you know, knowledge is what you learn from someone or from reading a book, and you memorize it. Krishna gives a list of qualities, starting with humility. Humility, compassion, kindness. And then Krishna says, this is knowledge. All else is the absence of knowledge. So we can know so many things. We can quote verses from Shastra. We can even speak well, eloquently. But if we haven't embodied these teachings in our own behavior, in our own life, we actually don't know anything. We become a personification of the absence of knowledge. The very first quality that Krishna lists is humility. So yoga begins with humility. My Guru Maharaj would explain that when a tree has something to offer, it's laden with ripe fruit, its branches hang low. When a cloud is heavy with rain, it also comes down from the sky. I don't know if you've seen grains of rice. When they're ripe, they bend over. When we're the smallest of the small, we can have a space in our heart for the whole world. So yoga begins with humility. And someone who is interested in these qualities, they're practicing the yoga of, they're practicing treasure hunt yoga. The yoga of the wealth of the gods and goddesses. So if you know that there's treasure, the first step is to find out where it's located. So this system of yoga shows you. And then of course, well, many other systems of yoga, most important and hidden in the center is bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion, the yoga of sacred love. So in the West, when you have a book, you put the most confidential things at the end, like the ultimate teaching, you put it at the end. But in ancient India, they don't do that. They tuck it in the middle. Maybe because someone who's not really interested, they'll flick through the beginning and flick through the end and miss what's in the middle. I don't know. But you see that Krishna's most confidential teachings, which are summarized at the end as well, but they're in the center of the Gita, the middle six chapters. And in Srimad Bhagavatam, the most confidential teachings are also in the center, in the 10th chapter of the Gita, 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. So the very first system of yoga is very surprising, Dishad Yoga, because we tend to think of yoga, most people tend to think of yoga as, you know, it's about happiness, it's about peace and tranquility. And certainly it's not about crisis, it's not about despair or difficulty. So what I've seen in the West is that many yoga practitioners, they don't know what to do with their despair or difficulty. They may feel that their yoga system, their yoga practice has let them down. In the West, as you know, there's a stigma attached to crisis. No one likes to reveal that they are in some kind of crisis. We, you know, hide it to the, keep it to the privacy of our own bedroom. And we will treat it easily with shame and try to conceal it. But in ancient India, crisis was not viewed in that way. Crisis is seen as a sacred rite of passage, something that is a natural part of life, just like you have summer and winter. In the West, we only want to see the summer. We hide away death, illness, crisis. So much so, a crisis can be so valuable in our life, so much so that it's accorded its own system of yoga in the Gita, Vishad Yoga, the yoga of crisis. Now, often we skip through over the first chapter, we skip over the first verse of the Gita and the first chapter, and we start often at the second chapter, verse 7, Karpanya Dosho Pahata Sabhava, where Arjuna asks Krishna for help. But the first chapter has a lot of secrets, a lot of secrets contained in it. Every verse of Shastra has so much in it. It's important to many who try to study the Gita on their own, and we will struggle. I remember having that experience as well. The Gita is not a self-help book. The self-help category is an invention of the contemporary West. So the Shastra and the Gita is actually much more like a teacher's manual. There's some great scholarly essays on this, actually, that's been recognized now in academia, that these are actually were intended as teacher's manuals. And a teacher, because contained within a single verse, or within even a single line, is a universe of meaning. And a teacher, according to his or her realization, will be able to unpack that, not only through sharing verbally, but through that person's own example in the way that they live. And so to study the Gita on your own is actually very difficult. And that's one reason why the Gita is not studied as much as it could be in yoga studios around the world. People try and they think, well, you know, I don't really get this. And then they put it away. So in the first chapter of the Gita, there's so much there of, in the way that the experience that Arjuna describes, it's not wasted space. Not by chance that Arjuna is explaining, this is what I'm feeling, this is my experience, now I feel this way, what should I do? Arjuna expresses in the first chapter four symptoms of crisis, which we will all experience. We will all go through, I call it a dark night of the soul. That's not a phrase from India. It actually originates from St. John of the Cross, but it's used now to mean like an existential crisis that challenges you right to the limit. Your sense of meaning is broken down. So that's what Arjuna experiences, and in Sanskrit it's called vishad, or despair. And Arjuna describes, and you see four main symptoms of a dark night of the soul. Maybe we'll look at that a little bit later. But each one of us will go through at least one dark night of the soul in our life. We might go through more than one. But there's very little in our upbringing or our education to prepare us for it. We don't know what's happening to us when that occurs. But that experience can be a very, very powerful catalyst for becoming a deeper individual. It can really deepen us as a person. We can, following a dark night of the soul, we can abandon the facile identities that we create and live out, the personas that we live out. And you find, actually, that some of the greatest authors, artists, their best work actually comes after a crisis experience of that kind. In the ancient texts of India, we see that too, but on a spiritual level. So some of the greatest works have been composed after a period of searching and confusion and distress. Srimad Bhagavatam by Shiva Vyasadeva. One of the great Upanishads, there's a section by Sanat Kumar that happens after an episode like that. So you actually have a series of teachers who learned, who produced their most magnificent spiritual text after an experience of what is similar to a dark night of the soul, but of course on a different level, because these are pure Vaishnavas. So you have, for example, Sanat Kumar, and then Shiva Vyasadeva. Valmiki also composed the Ramayana after experiencing the profound pain that was inflicted on a living, on a crane that's now extinct in India, but a beautiful crane with a red coloring on its head that a hunter had killed, and seeing the anguish of that poor creature, and also the female crane that was moving around it. Valmiki cried out and composed a verse that was full of grief, but it was a verse that was that mimicked the pain that he saw, but it was a new type of verse that had never been heard before, with a particular meter, and it perfectly encapsulated the experience that he had, and that became known as the shlok, which we all know. The Gita is made up of shlokas. That was by Valmiki. And so he composed the first shloka. And it's called a shloka because it comes from shok, or suffering. So four symptoms of a dark night of the soul. If we know what they are, then we can understand if we're going through a dark night of the soul at the moment. We can also be ready and understand if one is approaching. And if we have had this experience in the past, we can recognize it for what it is. And then, if we look at the way Arjuna, how does Arjuna respond to that? There are teachings there as well, three in particular, that help us understand what is the best way to navigate this kind of experience. So that's the yoga of despair, the yoga of the dark night of the soul. So, that particular book, Yoga and the Dark Night of the Soul, starts with Vishad Yoga and looks at some of the main yoga systems in the Gita to make it available as a set of tools for living skillfully in life, and then hopefully draws the reader to the most confidential teachings in the Gita, which are the teachings of Bhakti. To summarize, maybe just for a moment or two, let's look at the first verse of the Gita and the last verse of the Gita, because that, in a way, encapsulates the teachings in the Gita itself. We often skip the first verse. We think it's maybe just like introductory, not so important. And the last verse we often skip as well. But actually, they're very, very important. There are six traditional ways of studying a sacred text in India. Six. And one of them is to look at the first verse and look at the last verse and understand them together. So the first verse, as you know, is spoken by a blind king. What's his name?
Dhritarashtra.
So Dhritarashtra, the name Dhritarashtra, it has a few different meanings, but one of them is he, one who seizes the land of another. So the Gita starts off with the mindset of grasping. And the first verse is so important because it expresses the dominant way in which we approach life. Dhritarashtra uvacha dharma kshetre kuru kshetre samaveta yuyutsava mamaka pandavashchaiva kimakurvata sanjaya. So, Dhritarashtra is saying, his minister Sanjay has just come back from the battlefield. And he's asking, my sons and the sons of Pandu, I know that they went to Kurukshetra with the intent to fight. What happened? What happened? Oh, there's so much in this verse. So, if you know the background of the Mahabharata, Pandu, the father of the Pandavas, the brother of Dhritarashtra, passed away when the Pandavas were just young boys. So they were fatherless. And they went to Hastinapur, which is where Dhritarashtra is at when he utters this verse. And they saw Dhritarashtra as their own father. They would address him as a father. So there's actually no difference, really, between the Kauravas and the Pandavas. They are all descendants of Kuru. They are now all assembled at Kurukshetra, the field of Kuru. And they're all, they're brothers. In Indian tradition, you may know, they say cousin brother, which, you know, you want, what is it? Is it cousin or brother? But they see cousins as brothers. They don't see them as in the way that we do. So these brothers grew up together with the same father. But Dhritarashtra is thinking my sons and the sons of Pandu. He's making divisions. And his words, if you look at the Sanskrit, you can feel the fear in his words, the illusory ego and the attachment. So that's what that first verse represents. Interestingly, when this particular verse is spoken, the battle at Kurukshetra has already reached the most critical point. Bhishma has already fallen. And Vidura, Sanjay has actually returned to Hastinapur to let Dhritarashtra know. So there's an irony in Dhritarashtra's question. You know, what happened? Already the commander-in-chief of the Kauravas has fallen. The whole battle of Kurukshetra, Duryodhana's hopes are pinned on Bhishma. In fact, at the beginning of the Gita, he says, you all protect Bhishma because he's better than Bhima. He's going to win this war for us. Bhishma, as you know, he had he was given a boon, like a blessing, divine blessing, that he could choose the time of his demise. Imagine, you can choose the time of your demise. So he was considered to be invincible. But Bhishma has already fallen. So when Dhritarashtra is anxiously asking, you know, what happened? There's a real irony in the question. And the deep meaning here is that when we adopt that approach, that closed-hearted approach based on ego attachment and fear, our demise is already assured just by the approach that we're taking. So one important aspect of the dark night of the soul is that we are all storytellers. We all have the story of our life that we create. We're authors. We're authors of a story. I am this particular person. We have an identity in that story. We carry that story with us wherever we go. Much of our story, maybe most of our story, is actually inherited. We didn't choose it. We inherited from our parents, from society, from advertising, from our friends. And we carry that story with us wherever we go. We live out from that story. We take that story so seriously that we're prepared to fight for it. We're prepared to lose friends over it. That's what happens at Kurukshetra. Dhritarashtra is lost in his story of friends and enemies. And because that's the dominant way in which we approach life, the Gita begins with that. And in fact, because we, the Atma, are so much greater than the limiting small stories of human life, those stories cannot accommodate us. So at some point, circumstances cause that story to rupture. And when that happens, we're cast into meaninglessness. And we have suffered a crisis of existence, an existential crisis. So that's what happens to Arjuna. Although Arjuna is a pure Vaishnav, he does this for our benefit, so we can understand the dark night of the soul. He's thinking, if you look at the Mahabharata, before the Gita, he's boasting how he's going to defeat all of the Kauravas. He's ready for this. And then he asks Krishna, please take my chariot between the two armies. And there on both sides, who does he see? His best friends, his uncles, his grandparents, his revered teachers, his nephews, his children. And that acts as a trigger for his dark night of the soul. And he doesn't see the meaning anymore. And he says, I don't see the meaning of victory. There's no happiness. I don't see how this no meaning in this anymore. So he says to Krishna, maybe the best thing to do is to just, you know, quietly leave the battlefield. So that's one of the symptoms of a dark night of the soul. One of the symptoms is we want to withdraw from life. We don't want to be seen. We don't want to engage with life. Krishna actually says you cannot disengage from life. No one can stop acting, not even for a moment. Even the decision not to act is a type of action. And we all know that. Sometimes not to do something can have greater consequences than doing something. So another way that we sometimes, in a dark night of the soul, that desire or instinct to withdraw from life can become so strong that it manifests as a desire to take our own life. Arjuna expresses that as well. He says, maybe better is if I just rush into the battlefield without any weapons. Let the Kauravas take me down without resisting. So that's another symptom of a dark night of the soul, is suffering associated with time. We'll have a look at just two. Suffering associated with time. So what is that? Fear, lamentation, and confusion. Fear is suffering associated with the future. Lamentation is suffering associated with the past. And confusion is suffering associated with the present. We all experience those as background conditions in life. But in a dark night of the soul, I don't know if you've experienced, it becomes so intense that it feels unbearable. So Arjuna, he expresses that. He's lamenting the past. He's fearful of what's going to happen. He's not fearful of fighting, because he's a Kshatriya, but he's fearful of what lies in the future if he fights this war. And then he expresses his confusion. Karpanya dosho pahata swabhava prichami tam dharma samudacheta. I thought I knew about dharma. I thought I knew what I should do and not do, but I feel completely confused. I don't know what to do and what not to do, even though I've been speaking so long, because he's been giving all these arguments. He then says, actually, I don't know what I'm doing. Please help me. So those are two symptoms of a dark night of the soul. There are two others. And then Krishna begins teaching different systems of yoga. Krishna starts off with teachings of Samkhya philosophy, actually, about the nature of the soul. Because Arjuna's, like Dhritarashtra, Arjuna's lost in his story. So Krishna tries to say, look, don't worry about the story. You are the Atma. You're eternal. These stories are not important. But Arjuna doesn't quite understand. Arjuna doesn't understand how Krishna's response relates to his issue and his question. So Krishna then moves away from that and teaches Karma Yoga, the yoga of skillful action. Krishna then returns to Samkhya teachings towards the end of the Gita, in some of the most beautiful teachings of the Gita, on the field and the knower of the field. Then at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, you have the last verse, which needs to be seen with the first verse. The last verse is the Phal Shruti, the verse that tells you the results that the Gita can offer you. So you often find that in sacred texts in India. Look out for it. There's the Phal Shruti, the verse of rewards or results. Phal means fruit. So Krishna says, and this is a great verse because it has Maharaj's name in it. And it's spoken by Sanjay. So the first verse is Dhritarashtra asking Sanjay. Then Sanjay is narrating what Krishna is saying to Arjuna. And then at the end is Sanjay's own opinion. Having heard everything, he gives like his personal view. Yatra yogeshwara krishna yatra parto dhanur dharaha tatra shri vijayo bhutir dhruva nitir matir mama. So Krishna gives four results of yoga. So I usually tell yoga practitioners, if you're not experiencing these four results, there's a problem with your yoga practice. Every practitioner of yoga will gradually experience these four results. But so Sanjay explains, Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna, wherever there is Krishna, the Lord of Yoga, and wherever there is Arjuna, the holder of the bow. So Dhanurdhara means the holder of the bow. And so Maharaj's name refers to Arjuna, also to Sri Ram, because that word is used to describe Sri Ram in the Ramayana, and also Lord Shiva. It's famous as the holder of the bow. And it's that same bow that Sita Devi, no one can lift it except Sita Devi as a young girl, she lifts it. That's the bow of Lord Shiva. She easily lifts it with one hand. And her father sees that and then decides, the only one that was qualified to marry this girl of mine must be someone who can lift this bow. And then Sri Ram lifts the bow. So that's very important, holder of the bow. The bow is Arjuna's instrument of action. So the yoga teachings are not teachings to be contemplated. Well, they are, but not just contemplated. We don't go to the forest. Patanjali's yoga sutras are actually meant for people who leave the world, who go into a cave, who go to the Himalayas, and who abandon the world. The Gita teachings of yoga are meant for those who are in active engagement with the world. So the holder of the bow indicates that. That's Arjuna's instrument of action. So wherever there's Krishna, wherever there's Arjuna. So that means wherever there's a true teacher of yoga who is a representative or manifestation of Krishna as guru, and wherever there's a true student, Arjuna represents the true student as opposed to Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra and Arjuna, they hear the same Gita. In fact, Dhritarashtra has also seen the universal form of Krishna. Not the exact same one, but a similar one. In Hastinapur, Duryodhan tries to imprison Krishna, who's a UNP, or peacemaker, peacekeeper. Tries to broker peace, and they try to seize him. And then Krishna manifests a colossal universal form. And Dhritarashtra sees that. So he has seen the same, he's heard the same Gita, but it causes no change in him. Actually, Dhritarashtra himself articulates that. In one place in the Mahabharata, he says, I always know what is in accord with Dharma and what is against Dharma. I know, but I'm not able to follow it. So wherever there's a true teacher of yoga and wherever there's a true student of yoga, you have four results. The first one is Shri. Shri means good fortune. The second is Yatra Shri Yogeshwara Krishna Yatra Pato Dhanutaraha Tatra Shri Vijayo. Unusual triumph. So very important. Jai means triumph. Vijay means unusual, vishesh jai, unusual triumph. So that means not a small triumph within our own small human story. This is a triumph over our story. Vijay. Bhuti means strength. Some of these Sanskrit words have different meanings also. One of the primary meanings of bhuti is strength or power. And dhruva niti, abiding wise conduct. Dhruva means fixed. So it's very easy to be wise when everything's going well in our life. Right? You can be very wise, but where does our wisdom go when we're faced with challenge or difficulty? We may not find we're not very wise at all when that happens. So, but someone who is a true student and who has taken shelter of a true teacher, their wisdom is like dhruva loka. Everything else may move, but it remains fixed. And it's abiding wise conduct. It's reflected in the way that we live in the world. So these four results of yoga actually have different levels. Because as you know, the teachings of the Gita have different levels. There are regular teachings. There are confidential teachings. More confidential. Most confidential. And then the most secret of all secrets. So those four results will be different according to the level of teaching that we've understood in the Gita. So those basic meanings that we've looked at is just regular. It's just a general meaning relating to ordinary life wisdom. What to speak of the higher levels. So I'll stop here, but just before, I want to show the first verse and the last verse illustrated using a mudra. You all know mudras, right? So one mudra that's quite famous is the Anjali mudra. means, it has a few different meanings. One of them is my heart, and your heart are one. So we'll just have a quick look at the first verse and the last verse as a mudra. So I have here some semi-precious gems, gemstones. I have here some opals, amethysts, quartz crystals. I think there's a lapis lazuli somewhere in there. Now, there are basically two approaches to life. And this is so important because it can completely change the way that we act in this world and think in this world. One approach is the approach of Dhritarashtra. So I'm going to demonstrate that with a simple mudra. Basically like this. Okay. If this mudra could speak, what would it say?
Leave me alone.
It would say, I'm going to take as much as I can, and I'm going to hold on to it very tightly. This is mine. Because if I don't hold on to it tightly, it will fall from my grasp, or someone will take it from me. So it's a mudra of illusory ego, attachment, and fear. There's a problem with this way of approaching life, because one of the names of Krishna is Vishvatma, the soul of the universe. So if the soul of the universe, if Krishna wants to give us more, we're not actually in a position to accept it. Our hands are tightly closed. Fortunately, there's a different approach. It's a 180 degree, it's a inversion, which is to turn our hand facing this way, and instead of closed fingers, to have open fingers. Now this is interesting, because it's not only the mudra of giving, it's also the mudra of receiving. I think we've all had this experience. When what we do, we make what we do an offering to Krishna, the soul of the universe, our hands are never empty. We receive more in our life than we could have ever hoped for or imagined, because our focus is not on taking and seizing, but it's on giving. So that's represented in the last verse of the Gita. Yoga is an inversion of consciousness from becoming a taker to becoming a giver. Now, the palm in India represents the heart, like my heart and your heart are one. So you see that the deities in India, not just in India, even in other places in the Far East, they never have closed fists. It's always open. Open heart. So the Gita is about moving from a closed-hearted approach to life, which is epitomized by Dhritarashtra, to an open-hearted approach, which finds its highest expression in the teachings of Bhakti. It's a short summary.
So wow. I'm going to what's that?
Just wow.
Wow, right? Thank you. Your name now?
Rajarani.
Rajarani. Rajarani. Wow. Congratulations. Wonderful. Wow. It was great. You know, it would, you could hear all day. It's so stimulating. I just love, don't worry about the story, worry about the Atma. That's like an aphorism or a sutra that can be expanded unlimitedly. I just add this quote I got from Rumi. That's kind of like something that can be applied to Vishad Yoga, is when God is digging a ditch to throw you in, he's actually making a well to quench your thirst. Yes. Or is it true we're the chosen people? The other thing I just mentioned, then I'm going to ask some questions, is I just wrote an article, my last article was about the first and last verse and their connection in a different way. And I said, well, I never heard this before, right? And then Gail wrote me, well, it's right there in the first paragraph of Prabhupada's purport. Where he connects the first and the last verse, but not in the exact way I did it. I had a little bit of a different take, but I love this. I put it as the vision of a materialist and a spiritualist. Because the first verse is, he has the vision of his armies and the superior power. And the last verse is the vision of the spiritualist. It's not the armies and the power, it's the righteousness that leads to victory. So I had that connection. And I'm just going to ask you, just one question. We can also, I have many questions, but answer it, unfortunately, I just began to read the book, so I was reading the Book of Dharma. But that's good. And then in it, you had this brilliant connection between parts of speech, domains of experience, and Dharma. And you were talking about, communicating to people, in a cultural language, right? And it seems, I have a little experience, this, as you get into Krishna consciousness, do your service of applying your intelligence to Krishna consciousness, all kinds of things become like connected, So I'm just wondering, is these kind of things, like this connection, I'll try to find what pages I'm reading, parts of space, domains, and these four things, right? The way they're categorized, was it something you read or in some commentary? Or is it something that was there and then you translated it into something more modern?
So Maharaj is referring to the Book of Dharma, which is based on Srimad Bhagavatam, where there's an explanation of how the Dharma manifests when four principles are put into action: truth, purity, non-violence. Actually, Srimad Bhagavatam says daya, which is compassion. But I've used non-violence there in order to make it accessible to the yoga community, because then it fits perfectly with the yamas and niyamas. And I mentioned that in a footnote. And then tapas, which I've used the English word discipline for. People don't understand austerity so easily. And there are elements of tapas that we do every day, even though we may not practice austerities in the way that, like ritual austerities, which is sometimes how tapas is also understood. So in the Gita, Krishna explains tapas very much as discipline. So for readers to connect with that, I've used that English word. So four principles: truth, purity, non-violence, and discipline. When those are brought into action simultaneously, then Dharma manifests in our life. Now, Dharma is a word in Sanskrit that's used in different ways. So you may have come across as Dharma meaning one's purpose. That's actually Swadharma. The Sanskrit word is Swadharma, like one's own dharma, one's own purpose. But the more common use of the word dharma is when our thoughts, words, and actions are of such quality that the universe supports us or sustains our efforts. So the Mahabharata and other texts of India speak a lot about dharma in that way. It comes from the Sanskrit dhri, which means to uphold or to sustain. When we invoke dharma in our life, incredible things happen. And you see the application. Whenever we apply truth, purity, non-violence, and discipline in our life, the whole quality of what we're doing is at a different level. So to work on this particular book, I studied the commentaries of numerous Vaishnavacharyas, in particular 12 Vaishnavacharyas on those verses of Srimad Bhagavatam. But they don't explain the domains. That was inspired by some other verses from the Mahabharata, where it explains that the universality of dharma, how the principles of dharma reach out into every aspect of life. And dharma is the universal balance. So in the study of languages that I have been doing over many years, I'm aware that language encapsulates almost everything. It struggles with spiritual experiences, and some mystical experiences are also very difficult, but even so, that's when the poets or the rishis use poetry to somehow reach out and at least point in that direction. So for example, in the Upanishads, the explanations of the Atma and also of the Paramatma are astonishing verses of poetry with lots of contradictions, present everywhere and present and not present everywhere. It's the poetry of the Upanishads is reaching out and pointing in that direction, but also acknowledging that the words of this world cannot touch the Supreme Lord. In fact, there's one statement in the Upanishads where it says, our words echo back, unable to reach him. So that's when we use our powers of communication, material powers of communication, to try and describe something that is beyond the material field of perception. But within this world, language encapsulates everything that we can experience, almost. And likewise, what we experience will be reflected in language. So you see that, it's incredible in our societies. In our society, we have very few words for love and affection. Maybe just one or two, love and affection. But in India, in Sanskrit, I've counted, at one time I tried counting almost 30, and there may be others that I don't know of, different types of love, from very selfish so-called love to spiritual love, to various levels of spiritual and types of spiritual love. It's incredible. So that reflects the consciousness and understanding of a particular society. In our society, that little word love has lost its sacred meaning. We use it for everything from I love ice cream to I love my dog to I love my friends.
You have to be very careful about dogs.
So even the ancient Greeks, they had 6 different words for different types of love. But we only have 1 or 2. We have lots of words for coffee. Frappuccino, cappuccino, you know. That's where our focus is. So language reflects the society. And so because of the statements in Shastra that speak about the universal application of Dharma in all domains, then I saw that language reflects that perfectly. In all languages, there are ways of describing 4 things: doing, being, relating, and differentiating. In English and other languages, we have the parts of speech, which are like the basic units of language. They're the building blocks of language. If you take any word in the whole of the English language, it'll fall into one of these 6 categories, the 6 parts of speech. So nouns, pronouns, adjectives, and each of those go in pairs into these 4 domains. So verbs are doing words. Exclamations are also doing words. It's like an inner exclamation where your heart is doing something. Nouns, things, They're in the category of being, of what is. Pronouns are words that we use to substitute nouns, like he, she, it, they. So they're also in the category of being. Differentiating, we have adjectives. So this is a stone. It's a pink stone. So it differentiates the pink stone from the blue stone. Adverbs are also words of differentiating. They describe different ways of doing things. So if you say, I ran quickly, quickly differentiates between the various types of running that I could do. And then you have words that are relationship words. So conjunctions and prepositions, they relate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So these stones are on the cloth. That's the relationship between the two of them. So you see here that language covers all of these four domains, and dharma and its four principles cover them also. And the fit is just perfect.
Perfect. Yeah, he has, okay, nouns, pronouns are being. So in the Dharma code, truth is the domain of being. So then you have adjectives and adverbs are differentiating, and that's in the realm of purity that differentiates. Then you have prepositions and conjunctions, that's in relating, and that's nonviolence, domain of related. And then you have verbs and interjections, doing, and that's in the discipline is in the domain of doing. So it's actually a perfect fit. So I think you answered my question. Is what you do is you see these universal principles, you study under great teachers like Srila Narayana Maharaj and Srila Prabhupada and Vaishnavas, and the Shastra describes truth, and then you go within your own experience and own culture and see the same things, and then that gives you a facility to actually communicate it in that way. And I was wondering, I guess, is that the same thing? Oh, I'm just going to ask you one more thing. The first and the last verse, the analysis that you gave, right? How much was it you actually read that analysis, and how much was it that you kind of connected it?
A combination of three things. Some of this is in the commentaries.
Yeah.
Some of it I've heard directly from my own teacher.
Yeah.
And some of it just presents itself as
like that. Okay.
As undeniable connections.
Anna, you're an editor. Isn't this very interesting?
Very
interesting. Okay. Well, I had some philosophical questions, but I'll just say one other thing about one time I was visiting Srila Narayana Maharaj, and you'll like this, and it was the early morning, and it was about 9 o'clock in the morning, and he was writing, and he began to write, but usually he'd have this very deep bhajan of chanting Hare Krishna. And when I went in, he looked up and he said, I've been writing. He said, this is a very good Krishna Anushila. And Krishna Anushila, in the definition of bhakti by Rupa Goswami, he defines bhakti in the primary and secondary characteristics. The primary characteristics, Anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karma jnana navritam anukulyena krishna nu shilanam bhakta uttama. Your bhakti means anukulyena, when you do activities to please Krishna, krishna nu shilanam, that actually follow Krishna's desire. So that's what bhakti is, when you do activities to please Krishna or follow his desire. So he was saying, oh, writing is a very good Krishna Anushilana. And I was also thinking in a commentary that I read is that when you have to reproduce things in writing or speaking, you really have to be focused and attentive. And bhakti, the way that bhakti works is that when we are attentive or focused on Krishna, We feel Krishna, and that's the goal. The goal is Prayojana. Prayojana is the experience of knowing Krishna, is feeling Krishna and love. And it's based on your concentration. So writing and speaking, they're very, very powerful ways to kind of absorb yourself. So, Gail, do you have any question?
Yeah, I do actually. Do you remember?
She's famous for her questions. I'll just tell you a joke about her. Okay. She's married to an Italian guy. He's Catholic guy. And when I have my birthday, these professional comedians would come, and they would do these comedy routines. So one routine was a quiz show where they would give the answers and people would have to give the questions. So the first one was, you're not the body. So then someone says, Buzza, what has Michael Jackson realized? Then the second thing, a place where there's congregational worship of the Supreme Lord. This is the other clue. What are the airports? Then, this is also, guys, can you put up your hands there? People with sleeves here, Kishori. See, nice mom. Al, you know. So then they say, the answer is, markings of the body to mark that you're a devotee of Krishna. What a tattoo. So then the other one was 108. And then the answer was, how many more questions does Gail have to ask to Dhanadhar Swami before he wished that she became a Catholic instead of Okay. Gail?
I don't know if I wrote this down well, because I can't write and hear at the same time, but do you remember saying something like, there's a three-step process to applying knowledge?
Maybe three steps of karma yoga.
Yeah.
Okay. So what are they?
Do we have time?
Is it a synopsis form? I don't know.
Well, the first is being true to one's nature. So that's an aspect of truth. And it's so important. And in the world, in the society that we live, there are a lot of pressures on us not to be true to our nature. So, I don't know if you've heard of a palliative nurse named Bronnie Ware. She looks after dying patients. So patients who are sure to die, it's just a matter of how long they'll stay. So she thought to herself, I'm not simply going to look after them and care for them as best as I can. Maybe I can learn something from them. Because awareness of our mortality can give us a perspective on life that is often lost in the hectic movement and chaos of everyday living. So she began asking them, what in your life went well? Would you do anything differently? Do you have any regrets? And there was one regret that kept coming up again and again and again. What was the number one regret of dying patients? I wish I'd had the courage to be true to myself rather than to live a life true to myself rather than follow the expectations of others. So in our society there's a lot of we each have a different nature. We're not all built in the same way. So Krishna, that what she's expressing there, Krishna expresses to Arjuna thousands of years earlier. Krishna says to Arjuna, it's better that you follow your nature. So his nature is as a warrior. Better you follow your nature, even if there are faults in what you're doing, than to try to follow someone else's path and do that perfectly. So karma yoga is so important because most, I don't know if it's the same in New York, but in England certainly, the majority of people, they hate their work. Their favorite day of the week is Friday. And their worst day of the week is Monday.
We even have a restaurant called Thank God It's Friday.
So if you imagine a timeline, right, of 80 years, The average lifespan of a woman is 76, of a man is 73, so I'll be generous and give 80. There's a few years at the beginning where we're in school and we're, you know, children. And there are a few years when we're in retirement and we can do the things we didn't have time to do. So it's great being in, you know, youthful. It's great having time to do the things you want to do. What about all that time in between? If most of us are living in a way where we're deeply unhappy at work, we're setting ourselves up to be deeply unhappy in the majority of our life. So karma yoga is a simple system of yoga that allows us to find fulfillment in the work that we do. The first step is to be true to our nature. The second step is to let go of the results, let go of the fruits. Now, when I first came across that, I was confused by it. Because I know what it's like to give all your heart to something and be attached to the results. But how would you put all of your heart into something and let go of the fruits? Is it even possible? So that second step of karma yoga doesn't mean that you don't care. You care, but you put all of your heart into what you do. But then you realize that ultimately the results are not in your control. So Arjuna's the holder of the bow, Dhanurdhara. So use the analogy of a bow. If you're going to fire an arrow, you actually have to try and aim, and you have to do the effort of pulling the string, and you have to try your best. But once you release the arrow, what can you do? It's out of your control. So when we become attached to outcomes, it brings out all the unskillful ways of behaving. We become very controlling. We try to control situations and people. We become frustrated and angry if things don't go according to plan. I don't know if you know how they catch monkeys in India traditionally. They have like a bottle or a coconut or a bottle where the monkey can put its hand in but can't pull it out once they hold the fruit. So they attach that bottle to a wall or to a tree. A monk put a banana in it. The monkey comes in, puts his little hand in, grabs the fruit, and then tries to pull his hand out. But he can't. So by that stage, the monkey wants that banana. It's like decided, I'm going to have that one. It could probably find so many other bananas, free of charge, organic. But it wants that one. And it'll stay there trying for it until the person who captures it puts a bag over it. And they don't generally kill them. They just, when a town gets so many monkeys, they have to take some of them and put them in the forest a bit further away. So, and then it's captured. So we think the monkey is silly, but in everyday life, we're actually quite similar to the monkey. You know, we have our things that we want and we're so attached to them. So the second principle, the second step of karma yoga is to give up monkey mentality. And the third one is to make what we do an offering. So when we make something an offering, in the bhakti tradition, we of course make that an offering to the soul of the universe, Krishna. And when we make what we do an offering of devotion to Krishna, it completely changes our consciousness, our approach to how we're doing the work that we do. Even in simple ways, we're no longer going and looking, what can I get? We're thinking, what can I give? We don't go to a place and think, what are all the problems here? Look at all these problems. We think, what can I do to help? So it's a complete inversion. Those three steps, Krishna tells Arjuna, if we can do them, then we can make our work a form of worship. Imagine, we make our work a form of worship. So there are many other teachings that the Acharyas have explained about karma yoga, the difference between different types of karma yoga, which are very important for bhakti practitioners. But that's a simple three-step approach to karma yoga for someone who's new to the subject.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Kamala and Prada?
Hi, Krishna. Thank you both for this discussion today. It's been monumental for me, you know. I was really glad to hear you say so many sweet things about Srila Narayan Maharaj. I just want to say, as someone who, you know, has come to bhakti yoga and always felt drawn to his words and his teachings, but have sometimes been pushed away from it. And it was always very confusing to me because us as aspiring Vaishnavas are non-sectarian. And I never understood that. And I felt like it was something I had to have in private. And so to find Sangha that encompasses what bhakti is supposed to be, it's very important to me. So I thank you both for what you have said today.
Amen.
And I have so many questions after this class. I don't know where to start. But Prabhu, actually, when you were demonstrating with the stones, the first thing that I thought of was the monkey. Because I knew it from like an African Aboriginal way, because they do that, and then they give it lots of salt so that it will take them to an oasis to find water. So, but when you were holding it, the first thing I thought of was the trapped monkey. And then you brought that out again, and it just... There are no coincidences. But I have so many, but I guess the one question that I will try and form is, you spoke so much about the dark night of the soul, and I believe that Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj also wrote about, in using this analogy and terminology, because some of my service is Vaishnava care for the death and the dying and helping devotees leave their body. And I try to focus my specific service on counseling. And so when we go through different dark nights of the soul, as you were saying, and some maybe are grief, if you will, is there a way that this actually fits into the stages of bhakti as well? Because sometimes when I do work internally, I think of it maybe as anartha nivritti, and I'm not sure if that is a connection or not, or if it's just something I may be feeling, if that makes sense.
Well, Maharaj can answer, might want to answer that too. There are actually two dark nights of the soul in the Gita. There's, and this is very important, so thanks for asking that. One dark night of the soul is the dark night of the soul that Arjuna experiences. And we may experience that at various times in our own life, where what we drew meaning from in the world breaks down and we're confused and we don't know where to go. So that's one dark night of the soul. But there's another dark night of the soul. It's the dark night of the soul of Dhritarashtra. It's the underlying dark night of the soul from which any smaller dark nights of the soul will emerge and go back into, like waves in an ocean. If we can resolve the underlying dark night of the soul, which is known as avidya. So the dark night of ignorance, which is represented by the blindness that Dhritarashtra has from birth. And so the Gita begins with the blind king speaking. That's the underlying dark night of the soul. The smaller dark nights of the soul are very useful, because sometimes that will be the way that we are come to realize the underlying dark night of the soul. If everything goes well in our life all the time, we may never question. I have some friends who, even though they were born in the Krishna consciousness movement, their life has been so soft, and because of their karma from previous lifetimes, whatever they've wanted has always come to them very easily. So they haven't really suffered very much at all in their life. And then they have no, at this point in their life, they're showing no particular interest in spiritual life, because they've never had an experience like that yet. So the dark night of the soul is the type that Arjuna faces and that we will face in our life is a very valuable opportunity, because it can set us off in the right direction. And the underlying dark night of the soul that Dhritarashtra faces, has, and that we all have in this world, the process of bhakti and anartha nivritti is part of that awakening. But Maharaj, I want to say so much more on that.
Not so much more, just something more. I think, you know, destiny, I say, is the language of God. And I think what death says is the basic spiritual message. You're not the controller, you're not the controller. And when you get terminal illness, God is saying it so loud. So if people can hear that, you know, and actually surrender to God, even in a circumstance that's so much against their ego, it's very, very liberating. So that's what I would say. It's a situation that it's actually a situation meant for the greatest gift, which is to transcend that egocentric, I am the controller, letting go. So if you're there at death, you know, even if people are not particularly practitioners or something, you know, it's a great opportunity. What to speak, if you're a devotee and you know, and you're exchanging with people, there's an exchange of heart, and something of what you are will come to them also. Okay. Anybody else have any questions? Athena, you just came and
I've been traveling for over 2 hours to get here, and I finally made it. So I apologize, Hare Krishna. Thank you both so much for being here.
What?
Love Prabhu's book.
Okay, just wait 1 second, Athena. Okay. We'll just take a little break, and I'll entertain you. Okay. Well, he's got it. When Yadunath and Beth, and they became devotees in New Jersey, and then they used to do at my birthday these comedy routines. And one comedy routine is that they were coming into my birthday, Vyas Puja, to make an offering of comedy. And they were on one of these foot scooters. So it was like Krishna and Arjuna, the husband and wife, coming in. And then the wife breaks down. And the wife breaks down and she says, I can't do this. I'm afraid we're going to commit Vaishnava aparad. So then the husband playing, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, looks at the wife and says, oh, destroyer of logic. Oh, enemy of rational thinking. And then she responds, of the innocent you are O.J. Simpson. Of days of the week you're Monday. And of states you are New Jersey. And then... I think I'm in the wrong profession. And then another time they came in and they did Rap Stars. No, actually they did one. There used to be a television show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And this one was different. It was Who Wants to Be a Sannyasi? So they had this one person playing a brahmachari who wants to be a sannyasi. And every question he answers, he loses more things. He lost his house in Vrindavan. So, anyway. Okay. I just kind of entertain. Okay, Athena, now your question, okay?
Yes. Yeah. Well, first, thank you so much for hosting this. I love your book, and I can't wait to meet you. I really wanted to actually, elaborate, touch upon your last point of, you talking about karma yoga, but really the bhakti part in offering everything back to Krishna. But I think I've always struggled with the actual practical standpoint of that. So if we could draw an example, say someone isn't an architect, and that is true to the nature, how does that person think? How do they operate? How do they make that an offering? How do you actually work in a way so that it is an offering, a worship? And what does it mean? And Ramaswamy Maharaj had mentioned this actually in one of his talks, that you work in a way that it's mindful of the will of the Lord. But what does that actually mean? How do you practically apply that?
Well, when I go when I visit different yoga studios, often karma yoga is a topic that they're very interested in because it relates to the work that we do every day. And as I mentioned, there's so many people who are unfulfilled. Now, there are different ways that we can make, different levels that we can make what we do an offering. In the bhakti tradition, as you know, we will make what we do an offering to Krishna. But even if someone were to make what they do an offering to some the betterment of the world, or an offering to helping a student, or an offering. What they're doing is an offering in order to increase the level of consciousness of the world. Any time that we make what we do an offering to something that is not for ourselves, but something greater than us, it begins to change the consciousness that we have. So, in that sense, it's a universal principle that we find even at work in the best businesses and best organizations, in a very practical way. The best businesses are the ones that are focused really on service to others. They are the most effective. The best teachers, certainly if I think of the best teachers that I've had, academic teachers included, they have been completely dedicated to the to devoted to the student, not looking to try and grasp or take from the student, but just to give. So we see, because you asked about the practical application of this, we see that just regular application of this principle in the world of business and work has that effect. So in the mystical bhakti tradition, by focusing our worship and doing what we do as an offering to Krishna, the soul of the universe, it has an effect like that, but even larger. And we see that in the life of the acharyas. How Srila Prabhupada, everything he did, everything he said was in service to his Guru Maharaj and to Krishna. And in that way he achieved the impossible. So taking that in a practical way, what we can do is the business that we set up, or the work that we do, we find a way to connect it to Krishna and make it an offering of devotion. So I can, maybe the best way I can answer your question is to share what, in a very humble way, I'm trying to do with my own life. So the work that I do with the books that are published and the workshops and seminars that I do, I try to make that an offering of devotion. So any funds that come from that, I devote to worthy causes, like projects in India, Food for Life Vrindavan, the publishing of sacred literature by my teacher and other teachers. And I work 2 days a week or 3 days a week doing legal work. And you might think, well, what's the connection between legal work and an offering? But money is an energy, just like it's an energy that can be depleted and needs to be renewed. So every night after a hard day of work, by hard I mean like intensive but deeply fulfilling, you go and take some sleep. And that period of rest rejuvenates you to be able to do what you really love to do as an offering of service. So I see the work that I do, legal work that I do, as a way of covering the bills and accumulating the financial energy in order to be able to do what I really love to do. And in that way it's connected, and it becomes part of the service, loving service that I try to do. If I didn't have that connection, the legal work would be numbing. I would have no impetus or inspiration to do it. But as I do it, I'm thinking, oh, I'll be able to use the money that I earned from this to come to New York and meet all of you, get to meet Maharaj again after 25 years, or go to another destination and share these teachings from our lineage to others who will be benefited by them. So that's how I do that in my own life. There are many different ways that it can be done, and it will vary a little bit individually depending on your circumstances. One thing that I have found is that the more we focus on doing that, even if it's in a small space within our life, the space begins to grow. If we do what's really truly important to us, and it's connected to Krishna, even if we do that in a small part of our life, because it brings so much vitality and so much happiness and energy, it begins to grow. And soon it becomes your whole life. So be careful. Does that answer your question? I sense I've only
Athena, just 1 second. Kaveri? Is she there? We'll go about 10, 15 more minutes with questions.
Yeah.
Okay, so because I need a little time to...
I think my question is, maybe it's too specific, but I'm a yoga teacher, so I think it's a little easier to say, I can give the holy name, I can remove the bhakti center. So, but I'm thinking, even from a preaching standpoint, you say, offer everything back, and you have students who are in finance, architect, how do you practically apply that? And just to be a little more specific, we know devotees, for example, say they're head of big desk at, you know, these big banks. How do they actually make their work, you know, practically offer it and tie it to Krishna? Beyond say, I will take the money and I'll donate to temples and I'll give Mahaprasad. But the work itself, like, how do you make that in line with the will of the Lord? And how do you make the work, like, actually the work and the job that you're doing, an offering? I think it's just, and I'm trying to wrap my head around that per se. Just even from my understanding when I preach that, what does that practically look like? Because it's not, say you're in finance and you're making all this money and you're investing people's, like, it's not directly related to Krishna. And I mean, maybe the answer is that yes, you do what you can and you bring offered food and prasad to, like, your group, or you tell them about the bhakti center, you take the money that you earn and donate to good causes. But the actual work itself, how does that align with Krishna? And how do you, I think this is stuck just in the last lecture, just how do you operate in line with the will of the Lord? Like, what does that actually mean?
Well, one important point is that I don't think that we should, I know you weren't meaning to do that, but we shouldn't undermine the connection that we make by offering the results of our work. Because by offering the results of our work, we're automatically connecting the work to making it an offering. So that is definitely a valid and good way in which to make our work an offering. There are certain types of work that will be more difficult. The work itself will be more difficult to make an offering. And they may well be, and in some cases, maybe even impossible. So if we do work, for example, going back to the Dharma code, if we do work that causes unnecessary, that causes suffering to other living entities, or that's based on exploitation, what can you do? You may have to look for a different type of work. I do legal work with some major investment banks, and one of them is in California. And they gave me a job that required putting together papers for a huge firm that was relocating to the Midwest. And I looked through the documents and I saw that this is a firm that is based on animal experimentation and animal killing. So they were developing some kind of external kidney machine. So if someone's waiting for a kidney transplant, they may have to wait a very long time, and it can be very difficult. So they developed a system where they take pigs and they cut them and make some external liver. And they refer to the pigs in this presentation as raw materials. And in the Midwest, I think there are lots of them, so they wanted to relocate, make a big facility. And I thought, no, I can't do this. I'm not going to draft this. And this was my biggest client. And I thought, you know, I could lose this. But I was not, it's against, I cannot connect this to Krishna. Sometimes some work, it may be against our nature or it may be against Dharma. And I stepped away from it, and they actually really were surprised, and they respected that. And then that whole deal actually fell through as a result. So sometimes the work may not be suitable. But there are many other types of work where it can be connected to Krishna very easily. If it's a restaurant, you can offer prasad. If it's a workplace that is, an investment bank or a finance place, you can make connections and do side projects that are beneficial to the world or that support sadhus. There are, for someone who has some creativity, there are endless opportunities. And in fact, the jobs that you least think are can be related to Krishna sometimes offer the greatest opportunities. Those positions that are in finance and legal and so on, if we can touch the lives of those people, they can work with us and do incredible things. And I've seen that.
Okay.
Right.
When you were speaking earlier about when you start a project or something in a particular guna, that it can affect the guna, or it can affect the project throughout. And I was thinking, for me personally, to have all kinds of projects, and you know, how do I know which? What they're affected by, because I may have started them, and some, do you have any advice for identifying whether they're still being influenced in some way, if there's ways to start to change that and for positive?
Sometimes we think that that rajas, the quality of passion, is bad and should be avoided. That's not what Shastra says, actually. Shastra says avoid tamas and understand the limitations of rajas. So if you start a business, for example, with people who are very, very sattvic, it's impossible. Nothing ever gets done. There has to be some element of rajas. It's the force of creativity. And but if that rajas, most workplaces, I don't want to generalize entirely, but a lot of workplaces that I've seen, they're rajas mixed with tamas. And that's a destructive combination. But if we have rajas that's mixed with sattva, then it has creativity with sustainability and longevity. So it's true. We will start off our projects in many different ways, especially when we're not so conscious of the three gunas. And the energy, the guna, combination of gunas that something is started off with, flows with the project all the way to the end. So I was in one company that was fueled, it was a real estate company quite some years ago. It had a lot of, it was started off, the owner made a huge amount of money in a personal real estate portfolio, and then decided to set up a company. There was a strong element of greed. And the place was very dynamic, and it was growing really, really quickly. But too quickly. So there's an element there of rajas, but also an element of tamas. Because as the Gita explains, when we try to do something that is beyond our qualification to do it, that's an aspect of tamas. So the business started going into areas that it didn't have previous experience in. It was taking in so much money from investors and not doing the correct due diligence. And problems started coming up. And one joint venture was with another company in Europe that was even just arguably fraudulent. So there hadn't been correct due diligence. Investors started losing a lot of money. And then the results of that combination of gunas became manifest. The company went bankrupt after some time. So looking at that as an outsider, to see how the gunas at the beginning impel the direction of an enterprise, and this can be any project that we do, how that flows through and manifests as a result is striking. And sometimes it can seem almost as if it's impossible to move out of that. So if we find the first step, if we have started something in a particular set of gunas that is not favorable, the first step is to become aware of it. Because when we're aware of something, then we can do something about it. So that awareness already is half the problem resolved. And then the second step is through conscious effort to redirect or to restart. There are various ways that you can, without doing everything over again, relaunch or have a secondary launch or call everyone together and take the company or the business in a different direction, markedly different. And if you have the leaders, the board of directors, who all have the same mindset, and it's not simply you against a group of people who are all in Rajas and Tamas, then it's possible. And if not, it's not possible.
So we'll have one more question, and then maybe people can, you can sign books and they'll serve out prasadam. And I just mentioned one thing also in the Van Ashram system. It's not that passion, like that Prabhu said, that passion is ever independent. Passion is under guidance. So you have Brahmins and Kshatriyas. So like he was saying, the Kshatriyas give the impetus to act, and that the Brahmins give them the appropriate restraint so that their passion doesn't become abusive. So there's always like a coordination how to do that. Jan?
I once had a problem many years ago. At that time I was a student of Zen Buddhism, and I asked my teacher about it. And I was a lawyer too, and I was concerned that my relationship with my clients was very disturbing to me because I felt like they were always lying to me. And yet I had to continue with their cases. And I felt that the whole atmosphere was very bleak, you know. And I asked him about it, and he said he was Korean and his English was charming but not very accurate. He said, your job is help them. Don't check.
Don't what?
Don't check. That was one of his expressions. And don't overthink it. Don't try to, explain it to yourself. Just do it. So I wonder if you think it's that kind of compassion which doesn't lead to any kind of, spiritual consciousness raising on air, Is it somehow of a lower order than something that involves raising someone's consciousness?
Difficult questions. If we can do something to raise the consciousness of others, it's definitely, it has a wider and larger impact than being able to help someone in a way that doesn't have that dimension, at least in my experience, because it becomes a little bit like, how to explain? Well, this is very related to the principle of purity. So most of us, I see in New York, it's actually my first time in New York other than just traveling through, and I see going through Manhattan that people in New York, they really like to dress well and to present themselves well. So usually what happens for most of us is in the mornings we will take a bath and dress ourselves and so on and then step out into the world. But we won't often consider the purity of our own consciousness. And what we do then has a ripple effect that affects many other people. So, we'll be stuck in traffic, we'll be angry, we'll make it to the workplace. The first person we see, we'll, you know, we might say something to them that we don't really mean. That person then will, it has this kind of ripple effect. So purity is about not only physical cleanliness, it's about the condition of our minds. We can help someone in a particular way, you know, help them in a particular way with some problem that they might have, and that'll resolve that problem for the moment. But if we can also somehow inspire them, and we will also have the inverse, where someone else inspires us, if we can do that, then that change in consciousness has a ripple effect and may lead to situations where, or changes in that person's life and circumstances where that same problem that we had to struggle to help them with no longer even appears anymore, depending on the circumstance. So certainly to give help to anyone is a very good thing. And human life is meant to help others. If we can help them spiritually and create a shift in their consciousness, that's certainly the greatest help we can give.
Okay. If anybody, this his book's here, if anybody would like to get one, they can come up and you can sign the books for them. And how much are the books?
There's a price on the back.
Okay, there's a price on the back of the book you can see. Okay? No one wants any books, or you all have them ready.
I want to thank you again.
Thank you.
I want to thank Maharaj in particular for this event. He has always been very kind to me since the first time I've known him. And I'm just so happy to reconnect with him. I also want to thank this amazing person, Betty Ann, for inviting me to New York, and also Pallavi, who very kindly arranged for me to speak at the UN yesterday, the day before yesterday.
He was fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, people were like, normally in panels, like people listen a little bit, but they're on their phones, and as Simon was speaking, like he even saw the ambassador for India, like on his BlackBerry or iPhone, and then Simon was speaking and talking about how Gandhi invoked the principles, and the ambassador was like, and then just like, people all turning and looking, lots of people came up to me afterwards and said, really benefited a lot, so thank you.
I feel the reason it was successful is because the day before, I went to the Bhakti Center and offered homage to Srila Prabhupada. This is the place where he established Krishna consciousness in the West, and I asked him to please give his blessings. I think that New York is, I've gone to many places, and there's something special here. Really, there's a rejuvenation of bhakti and Krishna consciousness, so much energy and enthusiasm. So many people of all ages, especially youngsters who are putting their full heart into devotion. I've not seen that anywhere. So, my pranam to all of you.
So, I think we'll be around for a while, you know, so you could ask questions personally.